I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Ralph De Palma, who will be introducing our speaker today.
Thank you, Molly. Dr. Jack Tao, MD, doctor of philosophy, is a distinguished neurologist. He's currently professor of neurology at the University of Tennessee and the director of polytrauma at the OEF clinic at the Memphis Veterans Administration Center. He has served as a captain in the United States Navy and as former director of TBI programs for the U.S. Naval Bureau of Medicine and Surgery. His contributions to TBI diagnosis and treatment are many. We'd like to welcome Dr. Sowell.
Thank you. And at this time, Dr. Sowell, I will turn it over to you. You should have that pop up now.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, hopefully everyone can see the screen.
Yep.
So we'll be talking about the impact of multiple concussions on emotional distress paper that came out in the Journal of Neurotrauma in November of 2014. The primary author is Dr. James Spira, who is out in Hawaii. At the time, he was at the Veterans Affairs National Center for PTSD. So before I continue, I want to go ahead and give the disclaimer that what we'll be discussing this afternoon are the private views of the authors of the paper and are not official government positions. So in terms of background, the reason we undertook this work was for several reasons. One is discrepancies between reports of persistent post-concussive symptoms in the published literature, and we believe that part of the reason for disparate findings is that there's various types of population. So is it a sports population, military population, civilian motor vehicle accident population? And the characteristics of the populations may be very different, and that may explain some of the differences in the clinical outcomes. Similarly, there may be different levels of emotional reserve and other comorbid mental health symptoms that may be occurring. And lastly, clinical versus a non-clinical setting. So are they being seen for medical care, or are they being seen as part of sports evaluations, for example? We also, when we delved into the literature, realized that the influence of the number and the recency of when someone was concussed hasn't really been adequately assessed in terms of onset of symptoms, persistence of symptoms. Similarly, there's a large overlap in neurological post-concussive symptoms with mental health symptoms, such as depression and post-traumatic stress. And at the time this paper was published, there was no consensus as to the nature of what these persistent post-concussive symptoms were in people who had a previous concussion. Like I said, the data that suggests that there is overlap in symptoms from a neurological and mental health standpoint is from two main papers. The first is Vasterling's work, which showed that cognitive function declined across the deployment life cycle in Army soldiers, independent of concussion. That was one of the first papers that came out as the Iraq surge was happening. Cooper's paper in 2011 showed that deployment stress was associated with persistent symptoms after a concussion. In terms of short-term effects of concussion, from a neurological perspective, one is that it is a concussion after your head injury until proven otherwise. It's unlikely to be post-traumatic stress response if you have a history of a head injury. And the military set specific protocols and change things in 2010 to focus on event-driven evaluation, so that if someone was exposed to something that could cause a head injury and a concussion, there was a mandated medical evaluation by either your corpsman or your unit medic, and then a mandatory 24-hour downtime afterwards, so that if someone was concussed, the effects of the adrenaline in battle may mask the symptoms of concussion, and so they would have hours afterwards to declare themselves, as it were. We also know that from the sports literature, and that's Mike McRae's work cited here, that most people get better within a week period. And so from the original sports studies that came out, it seemed that some people got better in sort of a one-day period. The majority of people, sort of about 80%, get better within sort of a week period. And then after that period, 5 to 10% sort of take a month, 3 months, even a year before they go back to their cognitive and symptomatic baseline. From a neurological perspective, we know that some people do develop headaches after a concussion, and the headaches seem to be very similar to migraine headaches. And so the thinking is that either sort of that they had a predisposition to migraine, and so this has accelerated the process, because you can see it after whiplash injury, for example, after a motor vehicle accident, some people suddenly start getting headaches. So the thinking is that, you know, either the concussion precipitated it, or they were bound to develop it anyways, and it accelerated it. In terms of the testing that was done, the most sensitive measures that were found were actually simple reaction time in terms of acute concussion evaluation. So speed and accuracy decline, and it's shown up as the reaction time to certain external stimuli, and that's, again, from sports population. And then later on, people have noted delayed memory and executive functioning, and I'm sure all of you have read in the paper or heard in the news that retired athletes, some of them who died early, have been diagnosed with an entity which is called chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And so most of you, I hope, have seen the movie Concussion. I will make a disclaimer that I have not seen the movie yet. It's on my list of movies to see, but I have little kids, and so it's hard to get out to see movies. But from what I've heard talking to my friends is that it's a very good movie. I'm not officially endorsing that movie by any means, I should add. And then lastly, there is a known effect of emotional distress on cognitive functioning. So having the stress of being deployed affected cognitive performance, and that, again, was also shown in Vasterling's study. She actually found that people, when they returned from combat deployment, they actually had a faster reaction time. So that's to be expected and not surprising, given the fact that you may need to react faster if somebody is trying to shoot you. And then it's subsequently been confirmed in other papers. So what we wanted to do was to actually look at what effect how recent you had a concussion was, as well as the number of lifetime concussions a person had, and if that affected emotional, somatic, and cognitive functioning, taking into account deployment stress and the main mental health problems of depression and PTSD, which are often comorbid. And we focused on a Marine Corps population. And so the work actually stemmed from a separate project that we were working on. So the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery for the Navy and the U.S. Army Medical Research and Material Command funded development of a handheld computer for neurocognitive testing to be put onto a hardened battlefield-ready platform so that this could potentially supplement concussion evaluations in theater. And so as part of the testing for it, there were several validation studies of which this work actually came out of that. So we were supported by the Office of the Medical Officer of the Marine Corps to work with the Marines, since they had the highest sustained rate of concussion among the services in OIF and OEF. So we worked with the 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force down at Camp Lejeune. 646 Marines volunteered to help us with this evaluation process on the study. In terms of demographics, 234 never deployed, 98 had previously deployed, and the majority 314 had recently returned from a deployment, and we saw them around the six-month mark after they returned from combat, from a very tough combat deployment. The testing was done using this handheld computer, which is termed the Defense Automated Neurobehavioral Assessment, or DANA. It has three batteries, which I'll talk about shortly. 369 Marines took the DANA standard battery. 227 had a brief battery. In total, the DANA actually is set up such that there were not only mental health type of questions, sleep questions in a survey format, but also the cognitive tasks. And so when we segregated it out, not everyone got the additional tests in the longer standard battery, and so this is why the numbers are slightly different. In terms of data analysis, the data that were on both batteries was analyzed for the overall results. Excuse me. So in terms of how it's set up, DANA Rapid has three tests, and it's meant to be a 5-minute quick screen to either augment or supplement the military's acute concussion evaluation process, which is questions as well as the screening for the concussion using mental status testing, primarily looking at the a memory system of the brain. It's based, the MACE, the Military Acute Concussion Evaluation, is based upon the NFL Sideline Assessment of Concussion, or SAC, which is validated up to use 48 hours after the injury. So what we looked at in terms, and our goal for developing DANA originally, was to see if there's a way to measure simple reaction time and some other cognitive tests that would augment the ability of the MACE in terms of sensitivity for getting an objective finding besides the clinical history questions, which are used to make that diagnosis of concussion. So DANA Rapid was meant to be done in 5 minutes, could be done on the front line, so it had simple reaction time, it had a go-no-go test to test frontal lobe, sort of executive functioning, and then a procedural reaction time, so decision-making. DANA Brief had those three things. It also had a spatial processing. So you see on the image here, it's spatial processing, where somebody has to make a decision as to whether the first stimuli on the left and the second one are identical. So you actually have to do a mental rotation and do a comparison to say yes or no, whether they're the same or not. There's a... there's a code substitution, so you get a series of symbols and numbers, and so you're supposed to identify whether the stimuli presented are consistent with that coding or if it's different. And then you have to memorize it, of course, and there's a delayed portion later on where you have to recall it. And then it also asks the health questionnaires minus the suicide question. And then DANA standard, so what you see here is the that code substitution test. So DANA standard had everything. It also had a Sternberg memory search task, combat exposure scales, the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, the PCLM, which is a screening tool but not diagnostic of PTSD, and then a deployment symptom inventory, which is based upon the neurobehavior symptom inventory, which is a mandated questionnaire that is done in the military now as part of TBI clinic follow-ups. So for abbreviations, this is the abbreviation of all the acronyms that we're using and will be used later on as we discuss the results of this paper. So what did we find? Well, one is that we did validate that the DANA seems to work fine. But more importantly, we found that 25% had at least one previous concussion in their lifetime, and 7% had two previous concussions, and 9% actually had three or more concussions. And the reason this is important is because the military and the VA have invested heavily in looking now at long-term effects of concussion. Primarily through various consortium that have been funded. But the main question to be answered is, what are the intermediate and longer term effects? We know that CTE is a disease entity that exists, but is the risk actually, 1% or is it 95% after, say, 3-5 concussions? Or does it matter how many concussions you've had in your life? I mean, could one concussion increase your risk? These all have very big health implications, because if the risk is 1%, most people can walk away reassured. If the risk is 95% after a certain number of concussions, that may have implications for your career in the military, and certainly for the Marines, and also for the other services. You have a lot of very athletic people who come in to the services with a history of concussion already, and so if they are put into a combat role and then get a few more concussions during the course of a 20-year career, is that a problem in terms of their lifetime risk for developing CTE? Or is it one of these things where, after your third concussion, you need a different job in the military, so you have to be retrained? We also looked in terms of the study at deployment status, combat exposure scale, and then correlated that with the concussion number as well as history, and also the other questionnaires. We found that the majority of the neurocognitive tests had moderate to large effect sizes in the analyses. So in terms of the effects of concussion on emotional symptoms being reported by questionnaire, and these are not clinician-confirmed diagnoses, so that's one caveat that's important to remember. Having at least one earlier concussion was associated with a small effect size with emotional distress. Having multiple as well as recent concussions was associated with emotional distress with a stronger effect size. And if you had three or more lifetime concussions, so similar to what they're finding and sort of what they've done looking at sports studies, so they segregate by 0, 1, 2, and 3 or more concussions, they found that there was more than doubled the odds of reaching the clinical cutoff scores for PTSD and depression. And there's four times the odds for having a positive score on the anger questions. So in terms of the paper itself, this is the data and the analyses that were presented. So any past concussion was associated with these three measures, and then having a history of a concussion less than 6 months ago, so recency of concussion, was also associated with the higher scores. Now, interestingly, sort of if you had a history of concussion more than 6 months ago, it was not significant. Similarly, if you had 0, 1, or 2 concussions, and the key thing to remember is that most people didn't have any concussion on their deployment, so that was the good news. But for those who are unlucky to have three or more sort of in the lifetime, then this was also significantly higher. In terms of effects of concussion on the post-concussive symptoms, we analyzed the deployment symptom inventory and the sleep index and had covariates, the combat exposure scale, the PCLM, and the health questionnaire. And so the deployment symptom inventory with at least one previous concussion, somatic symptoms were correlated, but with a small effect size. Similarly, sleep problems were also noted. But like I said before, these are small effect sizes, so our conclusion was that the findings of problems with neurological symptoms as well as sleep were most likely to be seen in people who had a history of multiple concussions, not just one concussion. Similarly, the recency of the concussion, so having a concussion within the past 6 months, was associated with the categories of sensory, somatic, and vestibular and sleep problems. The number of concussions was associated with somatic, vestibular, and sleep problems, and then three or more concussions was sensory, somatic, and vestibular. Interestingly, two concussions was only associated with the sleep problems. So we again believe that this may be due to small sample size numbers from the history of two or three concussions. In terms of the recency of concussions and the number of concussions with the previous deployment, adding in these covariates, Again, deployment symptom inventory was a very sensitive measure to detect problems. And those with three or more concussions, with the last concussion being within 6 months, had more distress than those with no or only one concussion in the more distant past. So again, these are not surprising findings that sort of if you have a lot of concussions and then you have sort of you're more close in terms of time of evaluation to your the last concussion, it's not surprising that you have persisting symptoms. So then comparing three or more concussions to just one or no concussions, looking at the extremes of the spectrum, you could predict that they were going to have higher sensory and vestibular complaints. And then even without covariates, all the subscales, all the subscales were significant. But the main thing that we wanted to do was we wanted to have the covariates in so we could take out the effect of other things that were mental health that could affect the symptomology and try to focus on what we thought was persistent neurological complaints. Independent of deployment, the exposure scale, PCLM, and PHQ-8 were not related to post-concussive reporting except for insomnia, which is one of the sleep questions. And then recency of concussion, the number of concussions, interactions between the number and the recency were associated with worse post-concussive symptom reporting. And so Table 2 in the paper gives the data that supports that. So as you can see, sort of the breakdown of the deployment symptom inventory domains, as well as this sleep index. So any past concussion was not significant for most of the domains except for somatic, as well as the sleep index. If you had a history of a remote concussion, the sensory, the somatic, the vestibular, and the sleep were all significantly different than three or more concussions. It was somatic and vestibular. And vestibular, as you'll notice, it's slightly under 0.05, which is the significance value. So it's something to keep in mind. And again, that may be due to a small sample number. And then looking at 0 to 1 compared to three or more concussions, what was significant down at the bottom. So in terms of how does concussion, switching a little bit to how does concussion affect neurocognitive functioning. So the single concussion was associated with delayed simple reaction time throughput and procedural reaction time throughput without covariates. And so what the throughput is doing is how quickly are you getting through the entire task. So sort of having answered all of the stimuli and made responses, how quickly did that was that or how slow was that? And so the important thing is it's associated with a delay without covariates, but when you account for PTSD, the health questionnaire, and deployment experience, there was no associated outcomes in the single concussion. So that's actually somewhat of a relief. So that it's consistent with the sports literature that suggests you get back to your cognitive baseline after a concussion. In terms of recency of concussion, the effects of concussion within 6 months compared to never or previously concussed was significant for delayed simple reaction time, procedural reaction time throughput, again, without the covariates. So there's detectable differences, but again, when you add in these other mental health symptoms, which may or may not be present, it washes out the significance. In terms of if you have multiple concussions over your lifespan, you do have delayed simple reaction time. So reaction time slows down over time. Again, and this is even with mental health and physical health covariates. And then marginally associated without covariates is the other three tests here. So what it's saying is that simple reaction time is slower if you have a history of concussion. In terms of three or more lifetime concussions, that's really where it made the most difference. In the tasks that are being looked at, there was no interaction with the recency of concussion if you had three or more lifetime three or more lifetime concussions. And then simple attention and discrimination skills such as reaction time, go, no-go, which is a frontal executive measure, and then spatial discrimination, that was known to be worse. Whereas memory testing does not seem to be affected by this at all. And then, so our conclusion from this data piece was that simple measures of neurocognitive functioning are sensitive to the effects of three or more concussions independent of emotional deployment covariates. So there is a detectable difference if you have three or more lifetime concussions, but none if you have less. This is the table that has the data for that. That's table number 4 in the paper. And you'll notice that in terms of simple reaction time throughput, it's significant no matter how you look at it. In terms of procedural reaction time, it's the count in terms of going through it is marginally significant, and then go-no-go, percent correct. So in conclusion, the recent deployment, higher combat exposure during that deployment, symptoms that would put you on a screening path for PTSD with a high score on the PCLM, and PHQ-8, the physical health questionnaire, having a higher score, meaning you have more somatic symptoms present at the time of the evaluation, means that you see an effect on number and recency of concussion, the emotional distress, post-concussive symptom reporting, and neurocognitive tasks, specifically the speed of response, but not memory-dependent tasks. So your memory is just fine, but your response to other things in terms of reaction time is delayed. Having had three or more concussions was related to worse scores for questionnaires for depression, the PTSD, anger, as well as sensory, somatic, and vestibular symptoms. So our conclusions are that it is absolutely reasonable still to continue screening service members, and especially in the VA system where we're seeing the recently discharged service member in our clinics now, to use neurobehavioral battery, looking at attention and simple discrimination. But also you need to screen for comorbid mental health and psychological factors, which may be adding to the symptoms and could cause challenges in separating out, is this primarily a mental health problem that people are left with? So we know that they had a concussion. Do they have persistent post-concussive symptoms? Like, is it a neurological issue or is it a combination? And how do you want to treat people? And so that's been the challenge that the military and now the VA are facing with our OIF and OEF service members. This is the references that we highlighted out of the paper. And then at this stage, I know I've run through this fairly quickly. I wanted to open it up for questions from the audience, if there are any. And so overall, the conclusions are that having a greater number of lifetime concussions puts you at higher risk for other symptoms later on. But again, I want the take-home message is we have to be very vigilant in screening people. We don't want to over-screen people. It's reasonable to add in specific tests of cognitive functioning during the screening process, but also to focus in on other comorbid things that can occur, such as mental health conditions, and then to try to tailor the treatment based upon what their symptoms are and for the patient. So at this point, let me turn it back over to our moderators and ask if any questions have come in.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Dr. Sao. Yes, we do have some questions that have come in. For those of you that joined us after the top of the hour, if you want to submit a question or comment, you can do so by using the question section of the GoToWebinar control panel down at the bottom right-hand side of your screen. Just click the plus sign next to the word questions. That'll expand the dialog box. You can then type your question or comment in, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. And we do have some great pending questions, so I'll get right to them. The first one, what is the current state of Dana in the current acute slash post-deployment scenario? Is it only for U.S. Marine Corps or for general use?
So currently the Dana is being evaluated by the military for more general use. It actually does have FDA approval to be used for cognitive testing. It is made by a company called Anthrotronics. I hold no stock in Anthrotronics, and I'm not endorsing the product at all at this stage. And I believe that the military is evaluating as to whether they want to go forward with procurement for larger purpose use. I know that it is available for research studies still. And then lastly, one of the things that the military is looking at right now is that there is a congressional law that mandates pre-deployment neurocognitive baseline testing, which has been done using the ANAM, the Automated Neurocognitive Assessment Metrics. There was a very recent Defense Health Board report looking at whether you truly need a baseline given the current state of the science. And their conclusions were that an abnormal baseline is certainly a trigger to look further into whether there's existing problems. If you have post-injury changes in the baseline, that's a very good objective measure. But post-deployment, you can also see changes that are persistent after just deployment and after concussion, simply probably because of fatigue, or if you have persistent delays in simple reaction time, for example, after a concussion, those can be detected. But ultimately, your choice of how you're going to manage your patient is based upon the symptoms that they present with. And so if they have headaches, you want to treat the headaches. If they have pain, you're going to be treating the pain. If they have mental health sequelae, you'd want to focus in on treating that. And so neurocognitive testing as a tool is really primarily there to augment your clinical examination and can be useful in making clinical determinations, but shouldn't be relied on as the sole source of your clinical judgment.
Thank you for that reply. The next question we have, do you have any measures of effort slash motivation or even proxy measures? For example, sometimes you can use forced choice or digit span cutoffs.
So we did not specifically look at measures of effort, but in this particular study, there are times that we did look, with the Dana testing, that we did look at the measures of effort as part of the performance.
Thank you. How long were, quote, persistent issues, and how long after concussion were participants positive for symptoms?
So we looked at this particular unit around the six-month time point after they returned from their combat deployment. And so what happens in the Marines is that once the unit comes back, there's a downtime, and then some of the members will sort of be at the end of their enlistment, get out. Others will transfer to other units. And so that's why you may have heard that, you know, some units, literally people were back-to-back-to-back in deployments because they went from one unit that just came back to another unit that was going out. And so that does occur. And so that's why we were able to get a population, some of whom had never deployed. So some people were just out of infantry school basic training and into the unit, whereas others had just come back from the deployment. So we had a wide-ranging spectrum. And so in terms of longer-term persistent symptoms, the classic teaching has been from the sports concussion world literature is that most people get better within a week after their concussion. Those small 5% to 10% that are persistent symptoms may last sort of 3, 6, or 12 months, but people eventually get back to baseline. We found that to be a similar case in the military population. After they set up the concussion centers in Afghanistan, we found good recovery, and the time course was about 10 days after combat, on average, in our restoration center out of Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan. But there was a range up to a month. And so what we understood from the people who went back to duty was that they were just fine and completed the rest of their deployment. Now, the big question is sort of what happens after they return. Do some of them have persisting symptoms? And the answer is yes. And so the National Intrepid Center at Bethesda has been seeing patients for the last several years with history of TBI and comorbid mental health complaints. And they found that people were being seen sort of 2-3 years later. So the question is, are these the people who went through the concussion centers in Afghanistan or not? Because maybe if you didn't have the chance to make a full recovery, your clinical outcomes down the road were worse versus those who had a chance to make a full recovery were asymptomatic, went back to duty, were they fine? And so nobody's been able to answer that question yet. But we do know that people still present sort of 3-5 years, maybe longer down the road with persistent complaints.
Thank you for that reply. You may have touched on this in your first response, but can you remind us, is the Dana device available for use in VA research protocols?
Yes, the Dana is available for use, and you would have to reach out to Anthrotronics directly to get units.
Thank you. Do you have problems with diagnosing concussion based only upon patient memory and report when there may be motivation issues to receive a positive diagnosis?
So the answer is yes. Obviously, having medical history at the time of the injury and the event is absolutely critical because people's memories can change over time. If you were concussed and knocked out, you might not remember you had a concussion. And so it's absolutely critical, and that's part of the reason the military switched to an event-based system so that they could log it in as to whether you were exposed and whether you were evaluated. So for people who served in the military who were injured after this directive-type memorandum went into effect in 2010, there's actually a database that can be queried to verify if somebody truly had the exposures or the diagnosis of concussion that they may later seek further care for.
Thank you. From a PTSD treatment perspective, would you recommend using the DSI sensory and vestibular scales as a screener for further evaluation of neurocognitive disorder due to TBI in addition to PTSD?
So I think that you have to use whatever measures you're most comfortable using. The military has instituted using the neurobehavior symptom inventory, this 21 or 22 question survey, as part of follow-ups when service members are seen. And so looking at the scale, sort of the neurobehavior symptom inventory scale, it actually asks sort of a lot of pertinent questions. But ultimately, sort of it's a clinical evaluation that's most useful in terms of making an actual diagnosis or not of PTSD, or if somebody's on the scale to try to, or towards PTSD to get them the interventions needed to try to keep them from becoming a full-blown, having full-blown PTSD.
Thank you. Is performance on neurocognitive metrics based on normative data or compared to each participant's individual baseline performance?
So it's actually looked at compared to a normative baseline, but we also realize that people, sort of the normative baseline is sort of the average patient population or people who take the test. And so there are always people who have lower scores and higher scores than the average.
Thank you.
And so obviously, in terms of having a self baseline to compare against, that's very good. But the issue that has been seen in sports and as well as the military is sort of people try to fake bad. So they try to perform less well so that if they're injured, they're looking similar to baseline performance. And so I have heard of stories of athletes as well as military personnel trying to do that. Now, I can tell you from the studies that have come out, looking at the automated tests, it's actually much harder to fake bad than you might think, that there's ways to sort of see how well people are doing to actually determine sort of whether they're giving full effort or not. And then the one thing I didn't mention, sorry, was that intrinsic to the data, looking at how quickly and in terms of the pattern of responses can also be useful in terms of telling if someone was distracted or not giving full effort.
Thank you for that reply. How was a history of prior lifetime concussions measured? If it was retrospective self-report, doesn't this pose a significant problem?
So the answer is absolutely yes. So it's basically measured by asking somebody self-reported, like how many times were you actually diagnosed with a concussion or think you actually had a concussion, knowing that this is the definition of concussion. So, again, you're asking for self-reporting, but the way this was done was this was an anonymous survey given to the Marines, so there was no direct health implications, and we hope that the Marines were honest about answering the questions, but that's absolutely always a concern sort of in terms of any sort of questionnaires that sort of is there a recall bias, is there is there any incentive not to report or to over-report? We don't think that there was any incentive since these were all volunteers and it was anonymous, and so it would have no career or health or medical care implications for the service member.
Thank you. And speaking of over-reporting, how sensitive is the DSI to over-reporting?
I don't know the answer to that question, unfortunately.
No problem.
But we do know, but it's theoretically what we do know is that the military has taken the position that you should not over-query and keep asking the same questions over and over again, because that is associated with eventually people just saying yes, positive answers.
Thank you. The symptom surveys for PCS, PTSD, and depression can overlap. Have you looked at the unique questions in surveys and focused on those excluding the overlapping question?
Thank you for the question. We have not looked at that.
Thank you. Is there a difference in symptoms or presentation of patients with direct concussions versus patients with concussions from blast injuries?
So most people, it turns out, are not actually concussed by blast force alone. And what we found looking in conjunction with the Army was that there were very few people who were concussed simply by the blast or the explosive force. Most people, it was a combination of the IED or blast going off and then either something flying through the air and hitting them, their vehicle getting lifted up in the air and somebody getting ejected from the turret, or some other combination of events, or the vehicle goes up in the air, they come down, people bang their head inside the vehicle. So it was very difficult to discern sort of what is pure blast exposure and concussion. There have been research studies looking at the effect of blast exposure alone in the absence of concussion, and there have been certain findings reported about differences in performance after a day sort of blasting on the range in a training scenario. So, but in terms of clinical symptoms from acute concussion, we think that the complaints that people have from a battlefield concussion, a sports concussion, is very similar. So people have cognitive problems, people have headaches, people have visual problems, people have balance problems. So from a neurological symptom cluster that you might present with acute concussion, the mechanism doesn't appear to be as critical early on.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, have you done a prospective study looking at individual subject responses pre- and post-deployment to look for a change in individual symptoms report and then look at yes or no to concussion?
We have not looked at that.
What about using more objective measures along with the symptom surveys?
I think that that's always very helpful if you're doing a clinical evaluation. You want to make sure that they're sort of an objective measure of either like balance problems or if they have problems with vestibular, or sorry, with vestibular. If they have problems with vision, you want to have them see the optometrist or the ophthalmologist to make sure that there's nothing structurally abnormal about the visual system. As examples. So I think that absolutely it's critical. You can't rely simply on the surveys alone. The surveys can help you screen people to identify who needs more detailed evaluations, but relying on surveys alone, I believe, is insufficient for medical care.
Thank you. You mentioned a database in which service members' concussions are entered. Who has access to this database?
So the database is it's actually for exposures as part of the directive type memorandum that the military put out. And so the organization that can be queried is something, it's an organization called JTAPIC, and they're the Joint Theater, let's see, I'm just trying to remember what the acronym is. They're based out of Fort Detrick in Maryland.
Thank you. Were there any differences in injury mechanisms tabulated, for example, blast, impact, or accelerations recorded in the study data, and how many overall were associated with blast?
So we did not look at that in particular in this cohort.
Thank you. That is the final pending question at this time, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to give any concluding comments if you'd like.
Well, I'd like to say thank you very much for everyone who dialed in this afternoon. I know that everyone has a very busy schedule. Please feel free to email with additional questions if some come up afterwards. But the main takeaway message is that having multiple concussions in your lifetime it puts you at higher risk for other problems. And so the data from the military population are mirrored somewhat in the civilian sports literature, which also suggests that there are problems that arise if you had more than one concussion in your lifetime. Certainly more than three is not a good thing. And so anything that you can do to protect your brain, please do it. But also when you're evaluating your patients, you want to be individualized in tailoring the treatments for them based upon the symptoms they report, and you should do a comprehensive evaluation as is being done in the VA and the military for people who have been exposed to combat and had a concussion in combat.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on and lending your expertise, especially on such short notice. Just so everybody knows, Dr. Sao is generous enough to take the spot of the original presenter who had a medical emergency. So we really appreciate you stepping in so quickly for one of your co-authors. And, of course,
well,
thank you.
And we wish Dr. Spira a quick recovery.
Absolutely.
Health issue.
My goodness, yes. Yes, and thank you to our attendees for joining us, and of course thank you to Dr. Ralph DePalma, who organizes this and all of our TBI cyber seminars. The next one will be on March 22nd, so please do join us for that. And at this time, I am going to close out the session, so please take just a moment while the feedback survey populates on your screen and provide us with just a little bit of feedback to our couple of questions. We do look very closely at your responses. So once again, thank you to everyone for joining us, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar presentation. Thanks again, Jack.